welcome to day two of the Everyday Novelist NaNoWriMo 2020 write-through, featuring me, J. Daniel Sawyer, your host, your other host,
Kitty Nakan,
and two of our three guest writers this year. I've got to actually say
Alexis. Yeah,
there you go. There is Alexis, and also
and Gail.
Yeah, and Gail Carriger.
Hi. How's it going?
Our final writer is not here today. She had a very long day and went to bed early, but she did report word totals, so I will tell you what those are once we get going here.
Shall we?
Yeah, let's start with totals. So, Gail, what is your current word total all told?
All told. So remembering everybody that I started on a project, I'm writing a project that was already halfway written when I started NaNo. My all told word count right now is 49074.
Okay, and that means that you have a total of 1,704 words for today.
Yes, except that actually I did 800 of those after our conversation yesterday.
Right. Well, that's okay.
We're
counting on that cycle, so.
Yes, but I'm also on the West Coast, so I when we record this, it's very late for you guys, but it's actually very early for me.
Well,
so.
I'm doing the bulk of my writing immediately after the recording every night as well.
Yeah.
How about you, Alexis? What's your word total now?
I have 204.
Woo!
204. Yay!
That is the total.
All right.
With previous.
Excellent. So you wrote 198 words today. That's a massive improvement on six. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right, Kitty, what is your total today? 642. Bringing your total for today to 312.
Excellent.
And Dan, what about you?
Well, I only got to write on the NaNo project and not on the mystery novel that I also want to finish, but my total today on the NaNo project is 4211. Which brings my daily count to 2805. So I hit a really nice groove. It was lovely.
Good.
I got into a character's head and suddenly the whole universe opened up, and I love it when that happens.
That's great.
So how was the experience for you today, Alexis? You obviously made more words.
Pretty good. I really don't like what the words are, but that's okay.
We've all been there, I promise.
I finished my midterm, so that helped me with actually being in a word headspace.
Excellent.
Did you get some outlining done, Alexis?
Oh, I did yesterday. I tried to avoid that today.
And actually just put some words down, huh?
Yeah.
Nice.
I can look at how much was the outline. Yeah, so I've got 130 words that were not outlined.
That's great.
That's not bad. That's 3-4 paragraphs at least. That can be a solid intro.
If I knew how to write one.
That's how you learn, is by doing.
That's fair.
if you want, I can send you some of my very early intros. You'll get to laugh at me.
You're brave to expose that. There are some writers who, for a while, were like, putting up, like, they were doing, like, fundraisers, I don't know, for World Builders or something, and part of that was they were sharing their very first, like, attempts at, and I was like, oh, yeah, no one is ever seeing that. No one is ever seeing that. Like, I am.
We took a road trip when that was happening, and there was 200 miles where you were ranting about how awful that would be if yours ever got out.
Oh, yes. Oh, God. Oh, it's a
terrible
idea.
Those conversations has burned into my head. I hadn't laughed so hard in a long time.
Oh, the embarrassment. The embarrassment.
Oh, how about you, Kitty? How was your day, writing-wise? How's the story feeling to you?
Writing-wise, pretty good. I'm doing fairly well with plot.
That's a big step up from last year. Last year that tripped you up.
Yeah, this time it feels like I'm going to have trouble with characterization.
What type of improvement does it feel like?
Ooh. I know where I'm going with the story, so I have a roadmap. So if I'm stuck, I have some place to go, and that is helping enormously.
Did you put a lot of detail in that?
Not so far. But that was only about 300 words today. So,
oh, she means in the plot roadmap.
In the plot roadmap, yes. At least the key points.
All right.
Not sure what to do with the ending.
Yeah, I get that. I think I put way too little detail into my outline. Because I have no idea how to make the scenes flow. And how to get out of one to begin with.
That was something I had a lot of problem with last year. I remember I wrote scenes that were just people walking around for days and days and not quite sure how to get to something other than them walking around and talking.
It's like Kevin Smith's description of Lord of the Rings.
I think I'm actually in a really similar place.
So, Gail, how was your story treating you today?
Much better than yesterday, actually. So yesterday I had to get back into it and after having dropped it for a while. And then today I was back into it and that was fine. And I had, a mild drama to set up. One of the characters is getting sicker and sicker. And so the POV character is finally noticing. So that had to happen. And then we're having a big change of season, which is a huge deal in this universe because it's a natural disaster universe. The world is a proto world, so it's like full of near constant, like crazy huge storms and earthquakes and stuff like that they're constantly dealing with. So we're seasonal changing, so we've just dealt with like fires and dust storms and you know, crazy like serious dust storms that can strip your skin off and stuff like that. And now we're going into hurricanes
and then the glaciers are coming.
Glaciers move too slowly, sweetie. There'll be no glaciers. Yeah. I'm not dealing with glaciers.
Maybe hyperspeed glaciers. Planet-sized hail.
Pyroclastic glaciers.
There you go.
Yeah, that's
actually
a thing.
That would be a fun idea to play with. I wonder what the physics involved would be. If you might be able to get pyroclastic glaciers on a world that's cold enough that you've got like liquid methane,
right?
Or something. Right, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a sort of avalanche, but I don't, like, this is a habitable world. It's just very unstable.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so, and the whole magical system is built around coping with these natural disasters, and protecting the human colonists. So every time I am switching to a new set of natural disasters, I get to showcase a new kind of magic.
Oh, that sounds like
to cope with it.
Fun.
Yeah, so that's coming up. So I have, like, one character sick, I have new natural disasters coming down the pipeline, and then there's a whole drama over tents that's going on, like, at tents as in tent, as in teepee tents, you know, things you live in. Because one of my solutions for a situation where you have these crazy storms that come in all the time is everyone is mobile. So, like, so there is no permanent building structures except underground.
So it's like,
in the
storms coming in from the north, everybody move behind this hill. Storms coming in from the south, move around the other side.
They have these things called pods, which are basically based on the original. They pod down, so they all go into their pods all the time.
Nice.
But it means that, like, all of the assembly structures and the tent structures and the social structures are all basically cloth. It's all tent-based. So, so there's drama over one of these tents. And
it also means that people can listen at the walls.
There's no secret.
Is that what you meant by, like, social structure?
Well, yeah, it's like this is one of those things that's really fun to explore as a fiction writer, right? Is how does and something that I think about a lot as a social scientist by training is how your magical system and how everybody is structured as a result of that magical system impacts your building structures and your social structures and your relationships with everyone. Like, this is all part and parcel. And, like, a really simple example of this is how the double Venetian door became a really big deal during the Rococo period, partly because everybody was wearing these huge panniers and skirts, right? So, like, the design of architecture is influenced by fashion and vice versa. But the same thing happens with magic. Something that archaeologists love to point out is if you have sorcerers with projectile abilities like fireballs and stuff, then you have different castle structures, because everybody's going to build castles that are designed to deal with fire and cannonballs, essentially. You know, so you don't have these rounded castles that people tend to think of when they're thinking about, like, medieval castles.
You've got the star point castles, so you can set up crossfire.
Exactly. So, so if you have a magical system that involves crossfire, then you have different building structures to deal with that. And so, for me, that's very fun to deal with. And so, one of the things I'm playing with is if you have a post-planet fall colonization species or humanity, where your evolution is being controlled, which is what the situation is, they're not permitted things like refrigeration or plastic and stuff like that. And so, I have a whole culture that's very transient in nature, and that includes the building structures. But it does also mean things like everybody can kind of listen in on each other. But there's also, like, this whole magical system that's all based on the, you know, wireless internet monitoring technology. And so, like, there's no privacy anyway. Everybody is, you can be recorded at any time and that sort of thing. So
that's funny. Yeah. The setup for mine is that a reality TV show production company has, in advance of the first Mars colony shipment, has bought themselves a interplanetary liner that was never finished because the company that was building it went bankrupt. They've built it up, and they're sending an advance team to go set up all the materiel for the mine, for the basically SpaceX colony crew. So we got a small advanced set that's being sent by a reality TV production company. So the whole ship is wired. They're streaming 24/7. And of course, you have the reality TV producers that are trying to create drama in this life and death situation.
That sounds great. It's like Big Brother in space.
And there's a murderer on board.
Of course.
So how do you pull off a high tension, ultra lurid cozy when everything is recorded?
Yeah, I love it.
So that's my basic premise. I'm having
and
fun
also
with
everybody
it.
Knows that it's recorded.
And everybody so that, like, knows
so
it's being recorded.
Kind of
right.
Performative, right?
Right. And I've just written the scene where the mission commander gets all of the crew in before they ship out of orbit and says, "Now, up to this point, you've been surrounded by documentary crews and cameras. You need to understand the level of privacy you will not have here. There's going to be 8 billion people jerking off to you and looking at everything you do every second of every day. And if you can't handle that, you better go back now."
That's fun. I have the opposite thing. They don't have the same concept of privacy that we do, because they've just...
Mm-hmm. Right, because it's more of a communal culture, yeah.
Precisely. So they just have a different social structure that gets set up around this as well. And it's a kind of puritanical eugenics codes in place about who, like, about physicality and who can breed and who can't and that sort of thing. So
which, frankly, every culture up till ours has had those in one guise or another.
And it's in this case, it's being externally imposed, but
because it's
been absorbed as part of the, like, social structure as a side
effect.
Oh,
fun.
Yeah, you know.
Oh, this is going to be a fun one. You may have to put me on the beta list, because this is territory I've always thought it would be fun to watch you explore.
It's really fun to play with. I mean, one of the defining premises of this is that the magical system imposes a gender dynamic. So, like, if you become somebody who can manipulate reality, basically, in either mentally or in the physical world, you then are assigned a gender, essentially, based on that. And you are taken out of both the gene pool and inner relationships with the rest of the cast, like the structural system.
Interesting. How do you then deal with, if you're taking all the magical people out of the gene pool, how does magic perpetuate itself down the generations?
It's bred into the existing population.
Oh, okay. Like, so it's like double recessive everywhere, and then, okay, gotcha. Cool.
Yeah. So, but this is one of the decisions that's sort of been handed down from, like, lessons learned from past Earth, which is, if you have a tremendous amount of power, you cannot have scions. It's just not allowed. Like, so it's, in other words, scions are inheritors of power. So,
like a prince to a king.
a prince to a king, or a rich kid to an estate, you know, however you want to look at it. So if I've created a magical system where, you know, there are basically two kinds of magic wielders who have tremendous amount of power, I've always caused sterility when I put magic into a system. It's just something, it's just a concept I really like to play with, and I also like to remove the option of passing power on.
There will be no Kwisatz Haderach in your world.
Exactly. Exactly. And in this particular instance, it's because these two magical components are designed to literally save humans because of the natural disasters that are constantly occurring. And so the basic concept is they should have no other loyalty than to preservation of the species.
Nice. I like the game theoretics there.
Yeah. But of course, they are all born into a system where they have family dynamics in place.
Right.
So even though that's supposed to be stripped out of them during the process of like their education and learning,
it of course only works
imperfectly.
Yeah. Like the youngest child apprenticeship system in the medieval monasteries.
Exactly. And so the romantic relationship that's going on is dealing with both this imposed gender system and carryover baggage from their birth families, or lack of family in one case. So, you know, so it's fun to this is so me. Just
it really, I love it. Yeah, my the premise for this one, I actually this is one of those noodle incidents in my universe. In the Resurrection Junket and one of the Suave Rob books and one of the Joss Kyle books, there's references to this first Mars mission and the disaster it was. And so I've been wanting to go and write it all these years. By writing this, I also get to explain a lot of the strange structures around how you crew ships and whatnot that exist later on in my timeline.
This is exciting. Yeah. So there it is. So I set up the short answer is I set up three things that I'm going to have to deal with in the course of this one chapter. And so now I'm excited about life because I know what's going to happen. So I have stuff. Stuff to throw at my characters. So that's
excellent.
Yeah.
That leads quite nicely into the question that both Alexis and Kitty had, was how do we handle transitioning from one scene to another?
So scene transitioning is something really interesting in terms of, this is a slightly non-sequitorial thing, but one of the things that I admire and struggle to do myself is temporal scene transitioning. So when you need to move your characters, not just through space, but through time really rapidly, you know, where your book is covering a year or 2 years, which is often the case in educational books or the Harry Potter books, for example, cover big stretches of time. I rarely write that way. I tend to write pretty short compression time frames for my adventures. Another author who does a really good job at that is Tamar Pierce. I will script in I got to do a seasonal change here. So this book has to cover an entire 6 months, basically a half a year. And so I had to just outline in this is just going to be two paragraphs that interrupt events where I have to just be there's a seasonal change happening. Time is passing, you know? And one of my get out of jail free cards for this is I can literally shut down everybody, you know, so kind of have romantic events or things, but then I'd be no, we're going to just have a 2 week long rainstorm and everybody is shut into their pods. And that'll pass in some time. You know?
That's almost as much of a cheat as putting everyone into cryo sleep.
It's such a cheat.
Does that only work at the beginning or end of a chapter?
No, I was stuck. This is happening right. The seasonal change is happening right in the middle of it, actually.
Oh.
But it'll be scene break, right? So it'll have the three stars or, you know, there'll be a scene break thing. And that's that's sometimes what I will do is I'll simply just be no, we're done with the scene. I have transferred the information I did. I can have them move through space and time in two sentences in the next scene. I can just be we crossed, you know, we spent a week crossing the plains or whatever. And now we're have a tavern, you know, because I need something to happen. I don't want to just talk about them crossing plains for six pages, right? We're just
4 years later, after Bob's initiation into the mysteries of the magic.
But it's the Frodo Sam Mordor situation where I don't have Tolkien's patience. And I don't think modern readers have to have. No.
But early on in Lord of the Rings, there's that break at the end of chapter one. Beginning of chapter two is a 17-year break. And he just takes care of it in one sentence at the opening.
So, but that's kind of a cop out to the question of like, how do you transition?
Yeah, no, that's true.
The answer is like, some people are better at transitioning than others, but also like, the scene has to have, unless you're writing literary fiction, the scene has to have function, and that's to move the story along. So if the scene isn't like substantially moving the story along in some way, then you know, don't write it.
Yep.
Just jump to the next piece.
I have a hard time thinking of a scene moving the story along if it's not moving the character to a different location.
Oh, yeah. That's because one way to think about it is when you're moving a character to a different location, you're imparting information to the reader that's telling part of the story. And there are many parts of the story that are imparting information to the reader that move the story along that aren't actually moving them through time and place. So, for example, a new character can introduce something that has happened off screen when they're all, you know, sitting around and having tea together. That's moving the story along, but they're not moving in space and time. So there are many different scenes that convey information that the reader is excited about and is important to the reader, but aren't actually moving them through space. And that's the what we're, I guess what I'm addressing then is the difference between pacing and plotting, which is a very challenging concept to get. And I understand that.
In terms of scene transitions, though, there's a lot of ways to do it, but most of them build on the basic three, which are the cliffhanger, the dangling thread, and the match cut. So the cliffhanger is when you end a scene with something major unresolved and you end it focusing on the unresolved thing.
Like something explodes.
Right, like something explodes, or someone just learned that their mother is terminally ill across the country and they've got to go. So there's like, you end on a moment where they have to make a big change in order for life to continue. Something that leaves a big part of the story up in the air, that's your cliffhanger. The term comes from the old movie serials where they would literally end an episode where a cowboy was hanging by one hand over the side of a cliff. Yeah. What's going to happen to Bob the Cowboy? Find out next week! That kind of thing. The dangling thread is a much quieter kind of cliffhanger, where you close the scene out and you don't necessarily focus on the dangling thread, but the scene ends with an issue that must be resolved by the characters taking further action. So if in the course of the scene, say, your heroine and her boyfriend decide that in order to save the world, they have to go to McDonald's and get the special Happy Meal toy, and then they get on with other business, and then the scene ends. And then in the next scene, they can be trying to get through all the urban unrest and riots to the only open McDonald's in 300 miles to get the Happy Meal toy.
I can give you an example of the quiet cliffhanger, literally from the chapter I just finished.
So the
cliffhanger at the end of it is a piece of dialogue. So the main character says, "We're just friends, I promise." And then the narrator says, "No one looked convinced. Mars couldn't blame them since he couldn't even convince himself."
Yeah, that
right.
Makes sense.
So that's a mild romantic cliffhanger. Like, what's going on? Are they friends? Are they not? Like, obviously they're not friends, but like, that is insight into the character realizing that like he's not fooling anybody, including himself, basically. So what's going to happen next? Like, is he gonna lean into that, or is he gonna still pretend that they're friends? Kind of deal, right? So and as opposed to like, I just made something explode or throw somebody off a cliff, which I will also do occasionally, but less commonly. And then the last one,
the match cut,
Dan is going to come to match cut and or satisfaction.
Oh, yeah, that's okay. So it's four. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So the match cut is you'll see this is done a lot in film. And this is one of those you can learn from film. But film originally learned it from theater, where your scene ends on a thought or an image or an object or something. It doesn't have to be deeply integral to the story. It can just be like someone, it ends with your character setting a rose down. And then the next scene begins with a carnation in a vase being done up by a florist.
Or a gardener pruning rose bushes.
Or a gardener pruning rose bushes. And the connection of the imagery at the end of one scene to the imagery at the beginning of the next scene is like in film when they take and they frame a shot a certain way, and then they transition by fading to another scene where the framing looks exactly the same, but it's a different location, a different character, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, as writers, we can do that with imagery the same way, but we can also do it with dialogue. So you can end one scene with one character stating a piece of ambiguous dialogue, and then open the next scene with a different character, like their best friend, using the same piece of dialogue to start a conversation, like that kind of a thing.
And we can also do it with concepts. We can do it with sense. We can, you know, all different kinds of things, not just visual stuff.
Oh, and also occurrences. So if you're writing two flipped POV characters and something is happening in one place, yes, you can have them referring to it happening in the next. So like somebody is battling a major fire, and in the next scene you transition to the politicians who are trying to deploy the firemen or whatever to battle that fire, right? So you can go from a close-up view of something to a broad-scope view of something, or you can go from a heroic view of something to a villainous view of something, you know, that kind of thing.
Yep. And you can also do double-sided puns with this, which is a terrible thing to do to the readers, but it works. Where you set up a pun at the end of one scene, and then the first line of the next scene actually fulfills the pun. But it really works. And you don't have to be really obvious about it. It can be very sly, so that the reader only get it on the second or third read-through. But it'll trip their brain into thinking these two things are connected, so it slides them across.
And then your fourth scene is satisfaction, which is when you end the scene with a sense of satisfaction, which can also be pathos. So you can leave your characters like sobbing together because someone has died, or you can end with, you know, the end of a sex scene because everything came out great and everyone's happy, or came in great, whatever. And and that is a challenging way to leave a chapter, because the reader is left very satisfied and doesn't necessarily want to pick up the next chapter. But that's what but that's also what you ride, is you have given them a profound sense of satisfaction and comfort. And so what they're reading for with the next chapter is more of that feeling. And that's the feeling you play on when you have readers who really love certain characters and really identify with those characters. If they want to keep reading just because they want to stay in that world. And
you end on a triumph of some kind.
Precisely. So they want to see the glory of that triumph in the next scene or whatever. And then you can sideswipe them with something else if you want to. Right. But so there is, you can end a chapter as if it were an ending, you know, like a book ending or something. Mm-hmm. It's just a little bit challenging, because those tends to be the chapters that people go to sleep on. You gotta hope they'll pick up the book the next morning and want to finish it still. One of the things I will do, and this is a pattern I've fallen into naturally, is I was just looking at the chapter I just finished, which is four scenes, and each scene ended, one scene would end with satisfaction, but then the next scene would end with a cliffhanger of some kind. Because I write comedic and because I write generally pretty happy stuff, there's a lot more satisfaction in my books than in a lot of people's stuff.
Like mine.
Yeah. And one of the things that some writers will do also, and again, this might be a pattern you fall into naturally eventually, is ending chapters differently. So you'll have one or two chapters in a row that end with suspense, high suspense. And then the next chapter the third chapter will end with satisfaction. And that's just a pacing technique. If you're writing a suspense novel or if you're writing high adventure, then almost all of your chapters are going to end on a suspenseful note or a cliffhanger note.
Or you don't like want to annoy your reader and have them tune out the cliffhanger.
Precisely. If the pattern, almost every writer develops a kind of sing-song nature to their voice, and that's not just like the way you write sentences, although that plays into it, but also the way you write books and whole chapters. And your reader can get lulled by that voice. And so consciously breaking a habit as a writer is a way of like kind of surprising your readers and waking them up a bit, you know.
And you can also, once you get a few books under your belt, you start to play with that. So you learn to recognize your own story rhythms, and you use those on purpose, and then you break them at the point when it's going to most upset or unsettle or get the reaction of your reader that you're looking for.
There are times where you actually want your readers to feel discomfort, and there are sort of techniques for that. But we are talking about like smooth scene transitions, which generally speaking, the point of a scene transition is mostly to make sure that your reader wants to read more.
So yeah, those are the basic four.
I mean, and one very helpful tip for that as a, you know, for the writer in you is, it's good to stop a scene when you want to write more. Because yeah. same sensation. That's why you yeah.
Then, then you go to the next scene and you can start it going, and then you can pick up in the middle instead of having to pick up at the beginning of a scene, which is always a pain in the ass.
You can always, okay, fiddle, with,
you can always fiddle with things later, too. Like, you can always, like, I many times have I gone back in and, like, broken up a scene specifically because I want a cliffhanger at the end of a chapter.
Yep, and just stick a different scene, a cutaway scene in the middle.
Precisely.
And, yep, I do that all the time, too.
Yeah, and so you can, like, you don't have to present the end product in the manner in which you wrote it. You know, you can fiddle with it later.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, I know some authors, I mean, there are some books out there who write, you know, kind of don't write by chapter. They just write until it's done, and then they figure out the chapters and break everything up later.
One of your favorite authors, Alexis Chuck Palahniuk, does it that way. So he just writes and writes and writes, and then when he goes to publish it, he breaks up the chapters.
Yeah, it kind of feels like that. How do you guys decide on a time frame? Because I feel like the idea I'm going for doesn't really make sense in any time frame, and I don't understand how to write it in the time frames it would make most sense in.
You mean the time frame that the story encompasses, like the story takes place over the course of a week, or the time setting of the book, like where it sits in history?
History.
Oh, okay. I decide on it based on humor. Like, I set my stuff in the Victorian era and in different periods of history because I find that period very funny, usually for fashion reasons. So, like...
Too many years at Dickens Fair.
Exactly.
I tend to... Well, this is a bit of a cheat because I wound up setting myself a meta-continuity, so... Almost all of my books, except the fantasy stories and the one fantasy book, run on the same timeline. So they've got a shared history. So I've built up enough of them now that I figure out when they're going to take place with reference to what would be possible at what point, technologically, culturally, etc., where along my timeline.
Your time period gives you guidelines and restrictions. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, like, that's something to think about. Like, how much technology do I want my characters to have access to? You know,
what social, like, constraints do you want to have them operating under? An interracial or a gay romance set in the 1850s is a very different story than one set in the 1950s, which is a very different story than one set now.
Yeah.
And you get it's not. And you don't even have to address the issues involved in order for that to be a case. Just the sorts of resistance your characters meet, the sorts of danger that their relationship is in as a result of existing, the sorts of things that might pull them apart, they're just different in every time period, and that will massively affect the way that the story feels, the way it unfolds, all those kinds of things.
And the stressors that you're, the psychological, emotional, and physical stressors that your characters are under.
Yep.
You know, which are entirely dependent on their given situation. But, like, also it's, like, what are you attracted to, I think.
Yeah.
To a certain, you know, like, as a writer, like, what time period of history or do you gravitate towards or do you want to kind of, I mean, it is possible to write surrealist sort of outside of time stuff. I mean, the ever-present nature of technology in the modern age makes that difficult, but you can still, you know, isolate your characters with no cell reception and you know, put them on a desert island, strand them on
or in the middle of the woods, and
and you know, that kind of a story, you can play with the sort of tension of surreality by, like, dropping characters naked into the woods, and your reader then also doesn't know what time period you're in, because that could happen right
anytime,
and then you drop a nugget, like someone has a tattoo and you're like, okay. But, you know, like, so you can also use the reader's uncertainty about what time they're in to your, as part of the tension for a book, if you were writing horror, for example.
And of course, another way to decide what time period you want to set your stuff in is, what are you curious about? Or what do you know really well?
What do you want to investigate?
Yeah, if you know it really well already, then it'll be second nature and you can write it really fast. But it might not be as exciting to you as if, say, for example, Ken Follett with The Pillars of the Earth. Follett had always written World War II spy fiction. Everything he did was World War II spy fiction. And then he fell in love with Gothic cathedrals. And as he started just researching Gothic cathedrals, because he was fascinated about how they built all these things with hand tools, he decided to write a novel about Gothic cathedrals, because he wound up with all this research and he just didn't want to let it go. So he had to figure out a reason to spend all the time that made that made sense. So he wrote a book about building a Gothic cathedral.
Okay.
Yeah, and then sometimes the story concept itself dictates what's... Like, I almost always end up writing sci-fi when I have a high concept, you know, thing that I want to play with. Like, in this case, you know, like... social structures and gender dynamics and, you know, that sort of, it's disguised as fantasy, but it's really sci-fi, you know? So like sometimes the story itself is like, yeah, what you write with that is this thing, right? You know, especially if you're a genre writer.
True, true. All right. Well, that's a nice, oh yeah, we got a good healthy episode today.
Yeah, it's fat.
Yep. I suppose we ought to all get on with our word counts. So.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us, and we will see all of you tomorrow.
Talk to you all tomorrow. Bye.
Good night.
Bye.
Good night.